Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Jack Rabbit of the band Springhouse. Springhouse was active in the early 1990s, recording two albums, Landfalls and Postcards from the Arctic. They broke up after the latter, around 1993, and later reconvened to make the 2008 album From Now to OK. From Now to OK has recently been reissued, and Rabbit discusses the life of that album as well as its recording, plus many topics that involve rock and popular music. Rabbit, as you may know, is also the longtime editor and publisher of the music magazine The Big Takeover. That's Jack Rabbit on Into Music, coming up now. I was thinking there's this this thing that happens, and this might be appropriate to Springhouse, where sometimes you get in a band and then the band doesn't let you go.
That's hilarious. That's a perspective I haven't heard before. And I've been on the other side of it as a, you know, music journalist for 45 years. Watching other bands, you know, in every generation so far. So you may have a point there. Happened to so many bands, really, particularly germane to us, too, because we're such good friends. Mitch and I were close friends before the band even formed, and that's never changed, you know, band or no band. And Larry, who got enormously close to during the, I guess it was five years that we were originally around in a normal functioning rehearsing, writing, recording band, touring band. So a lot of it has to do with that, in our case, anyway. And the rest of it is just down to people not forgetting our music, which would have been easy to do. You know, I don't have these illusions that we were such a great band that we couldn't be forgotten. But again, as someone who writes about other bands and doesn't forget them when they're gone, the music will tell the tale. If anybody finds quality in it, they'll continue to play it long after you're gone.
So, I mean, that's the thing, right? Is that you had these kind of periods of inactivity or breakup, whatever you want to call it, and then you would kind of come back together. And you did this in 2018 or 2008. So what were the circumstances that brought you together for this album?
To be honest, we've really been broken up since 1993. We had a farewell show.
Okay.
And it was not like, you know, false advertising. To me, the big difference is that from 88 to 93, we had a rehearsal space. We met 3 days a week. We thought constantly about the band the other 4 days of the week. You know, like we were working, we were writing songs. Mitch certainly was. I was working on lyrics. Eventually, Mitch kind of took over the lyrics on the second album because he was getting divorced. which will have an amazing effect on you suddenly having a lot to say, you know, for whatever good or bad. But, and Larry was constantly tinkering with the arrangements. And, you know, I was booking gigs. I was talking to people about gigs. I was talking to other bands about playing with them. It was kind of an immersive experience, even though all three of us had other jobs. You know, I was working at an insurance company. Mitch was a, you know, fire department lieutenant, EMT. Larry was working at restaurants and stuff. So it was just like what little free time we had from a 40-hour work week, we were working on the band. Okay, so a year goes by. In 94, we get an offer to open for half of the Chameleons, doing Chameleon songs. And we just said yes, all three of us, just like a year later. Because it was just for one tour, you know, like why say no? And that happened again in 2002, 8 years later, we did an East Coast dates of the Chameleons full band tour. So, and then again, 2008, we did some shows to promote the album when it came out. In 2010, we played the Big Takeover 30th Anniversary Festival. And then 2018, so every 8 years, you see, we got an offer to play the Kalamazoo Gazer Festival with Ringo Death Star and Soft Science and bunch of really great bands, Brief Candles. So we said yes again. And then we did the Chills tour because we hadn't played the East Coast. And then a couple weeks ago, we got together and we filmed a reunion show, just the three of us, no audience, to promote this new reissue. So we really have been broken up. We just keep coming back together for specific things that make us super happy. I mean, super happy. It is all the greatness of being in a band and none of the baggage. Not trudging to rehearsal, going like, "Oh God, rehearsal again today," or "Oh God, here's this terrible gig that we have to play because the management insists upon it or the booking agent insists upon it," or none of that stuff. Just we really enjoy the music and being together and playing these wonderful shows. And the album that you're speaking of, to finally answer your question, was an outgrowth of that. Mitch was going to make a solo album, and he made the mistake of playing me and Larry the demos, and we both went crazy over them. He was singing with a guitar and a voice, nothing else on these demos. And then he asked Larry to produce it, and he was like, "Yeah, I want to do that." And they were like, "Well, should we get to play drums?" And like, "Should we ask Jack?" We're like, "Yeah, let's get Jack to do it." And then we're like, "Oh shoot, well, this doesn't really sound like a Mitch solo album anymore." And then that was like the late 90s, and it took us almost 8 or 9 years to finish that album.
So I have to wonder, I want to go back. You talked about being such good friends and then the grind of being in a band. I wonder if in some ways, like putting an end to the band was like, this will preserve the friendships.
I wouldn't say that because Mitch and I were always going to be close friends, again, because we had been such close friends before and we lived near each other. We'd get together and just chat about other stuff too, not band-wise, like what records we were listening to, our personal lives, the things that friends do, even in their late 20s and early 30s. And the thing about Larry is that he was such a close friend. We did have some real blow-ups in that band, one on each of our three major tours, usually near the end of them. And then like the next day, we'd all be like, "Goodness, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry we did that. I don't mean a single thing I said," that kind of thing. It's just the tour is getting to us. Our touring just really drove us down, I think. We did really well in the big cities and a few very surprising small cities. But so we did 7 weeks in 93 for the Postcards from the Arctic album. That was like the entire country, the East, the Northeast, Toronto, this California into Texas, across to like Florida. It was just like an enormous amount of drumming, enormous amount of driving for an album that the record company was not supporting well. In between our first two albums, Nirvana happened, you see. And so our career was kind of immediately extraneous because we weren't making that kind of really in your face, kind of punk grunge, testosterone filled, super, appealing to teenagers who were, mad kind of music, because we weren't anymore. I made punk rock in the early 80s in my band even worse, when nobody was interested in punk rock in this country other than punk rockers from 80 to 84. So to me, it was kind of a joke. Like, really? Now you guys want loud, angry music that's half as good as the music I was listening to 14 years ago? Nothing against Nirvana, but people wanted Stone Temple Pilots, basically. That's what they wanted. They wanted Bush, that kind of stuff. This kind of like faux indie rock that wasn't indie rock at all. It was just warmed over hard rock. And here we are playing, Landfalls and Postcard from the Arctic. And we're dying a million deaths on this tour, basically. And our van got broken into in San Diego. That cost us like $6,000. There was a lot to it. And then we got dropped from our record deal. We had no money to record a demo in those days when you didn't record at home. Our band imploded for like 10 different reasons all at once. It was like the 2x4s that broke the camel's back, all bang, 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 bang. So I don't think we could have survived it. I don't think most bands could have. Fortunately, we'd sold like 10 or 15,000 copies of our two albums, being on a really good indie, Caroline Records, which had Virgin Records money. And as a result, pockets of people remembered us despite our records going out of print. And that's the thing that keeps getting us to come back, is we do like to be together, but there has to be some demand. Our demand was crumbling in 1993. And do you know that, like, when you get divorced, people say, like, the lifestyle in which I am accustomed, do you know that phrase?
Yes.
It's really hard when you've made a couple albums and toured three times, seen the whole country and Canada and stuff, to like just go back to playing CBGBs for the in our case, 27 times we played there or any of the other local clubs, just for your friends to come out and like the again, the pockets of fans you have, it just feels like you're spinning your wheels for nothing if you don't get a new record deal, if you don't start mounting new albums. And we could have done it if it was now. You know, bands just continue. They lose their record deals, or they never had one in the first place, because now it's cheap to record. We needed $6,000 just to record the first six songs we had on Landfalls, which we fronted ourselves back in January 89. That's when we recorded that. It took us two and a half years to get a record deal and record four more songs and make an album out of that. That's not an impediment for bands anymore. They record whole albums now for like $600. Totally, you know, reasonable, well-recorded, well-produced, well-engineered albums. The other thing is that having spent $6,000 to record those first six songs, we had nothing to do with them. You know, nowadays you stick them up on the internet and people can hear them. We didn't have that option. It was either cassettes or vinyl or nothing back in January 89. So without a record deal, it would have been pointless to try and come up with another $4,000 to press up albums for a band no one knew outside of New York, you know? It's a totally different ball game nowadays. Which is another way to answer your question, that like people are remembering us now because they can hear our music for free. We'd play these tours and people would know two of our songs, which is frustrating. Like even in gigs we did well, people would go crazy over Layers and All About Me, and they wouldn't know any of the other songs. We'd be like, well, we're here for another 40 minutes. Because they'd heard them on the radio or on MTV. And now, you know, people know every one of your songs. They know your B-sides. You can't just say, like, well, here's a song you don't know because it was on the B-side of some such and such. They're like, oh, yeah, I know that. If they're a fan, I know everybody's B-sides from buying their records, you know. My son, he's 17. He does this to me now. He goes, like, you don't know this Sloan song? I thought you knew all of Sloan's songs. I'm like, well, I feel like I know all the ones from their albums. Is this not on their album? Like, yeah, it's a B-side from 1993. I'm like, get out of here. You weren't even born. Well, I had to reach into my pocket to buy those records, you know? So it's a very different world now.
I mean, to get out word, you would have been dealing with print magazines. It's expensive to buy an ad, and then an ad obviously doesn't equate sales. And then even just having the money to get like a college radio campaign or something probably would have been difficult for you at that time too.
And you're describing the difference between our third album and the first two. Yes. We did wait those 2.5 years before we got a record deal. And it was an indie deal. You know, it wasn't like we'd signed a Geffen or something like that. But as indie deals go, it was really generous. Like we were given like a $15,000. And from that, we could record those last four songs and, you know, get a tour van that we could rent for our tour. You know, there were budgets. There was also a department there that did nothing but try to chase down radio for us. And there was a department that did nothing but try to chase down press for us. Chuck and God, what was Chuck's last name? Like Panasrian or something? I can't remember anymore because it was 34 years ago. But Janet Billig, who worked press, they both did such a great job. You know, again, we weren't very punk rock. We were sneered at in some corners because we used guitar effects in 1991, pre-Nirvana, but still when a lot of people equated like harsh, nasty, and aggressive music as being authentically American somehow. Like Helmet was a really popular band at that time. Nothing against them, but that was considered the American music in a lot of quarters if you were into underground music as opposed to commercial radio pop. And here we were playing with Kitchens of Distinction, we were playing with Ride, we were playing with the House of Love, we were playing with Galaxy 500, which was one of the few bands here doing something kind of similar. We were playing with the Ocean Blue, which was another one. We tried to get every gig we could with bands that were doing something else. But we also played with Jesus Lizard, and we played with Grant Hart, you know, anything we could do to try and broaden our interest in our band. But yes, it was a big thing having people actually mount those budgets on our behalf. And there was a ad budget as well. And that's how we ended up selling the records we did, because obviously not 10 or 15,000 people saw us play on those tours. Somebody had to just buy the record because they heard a song. And it was always just one song they heard. You asked a lot of fans back then to take a flyer, basically, to take a chance. say, like, I like that song, you know, and go through the usual network. Anybody have this record? I can hear some more songs. Can I hear it at the radio station or at the record store? The review I saw in the fanzine said it was good. That it was a ton of word of mouth, basically. And then our third album, we self-financed and kind of self-released with independent projects. And there was none of that kind of machine behind it. And we struggled to even sell the few, again, I don't know, we pressed up 1,000 copies or something. And in 2008, when it came out, you couldn't just sell digital copies. So this record is being better heard now than when it came out.
It's interesting in the, you know, in the early days that you're talking about, like you're mentioning Ocean Blue and Galaxy 500, and even Springhouse. These are bands that I didn't hear of, honestly, until years later. And I think some of it was that kind of binary at the cusp of the 80s, 90s that you're talking about, where it was like there was the pop music, and then there were like the metal bands, and there wasn't like a lot of room for this other stuff. It wasn't like a, you know.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we also play with Belly and Velocity Girl three times, and we did a really nice gig with Luna and the Bats the night the World Trade Center was bombed the first time, you know, when like five people were killed instead of thousands, and the subway shut down, so people had to walk like an hour and a half to come see the gig, that kind of thing. We really played with almost every band there was back then that were not commercial pop. Like our first New York gig was with Naked Raygun. You know, we played with Flower, who were absolutely incredible. The Chills and Blake Babies, we opened for them in North Carolina in 1990. What a wonderful night that was at Cat's Cradle. You know, venturing all the way 10-hour drive just when we had one single out, that kind of thing. But that's what bands did back then. You know, it doesn't make us heroes. You got in the van, we drove down to Philadelphia with no records. We opened for Chris Stamey. You know, things like that. We played with Matthew Sweet. I remember pestering Richard Lloyd from television with questions for an hour, since I had him to myself backstage for an hour after sound check. You know, and like asking him stuff like, "Does Matthew get this high for every sound check?" That kind of thing. You know, we had a lot of fun doing these gigs. The virtue of my being a music writer and having my own magazine is it gave us an in. I knew all these bands. Mitch knew them all too, being the consummate fan he was. So like we would buy Ride's record when they had one single out and end up, we opened for their first New York show ever at Maxwell's in 1990. We were in on the ground floor basically at the get-go on all these bands. Kitchen of Distinction were just like the nicest people, you know, playing with them. Very fortunate to share stages with these people and dinner. Not just the stage, but dinner basically. And, you know, tell them how much we love them. We got to be really good friends with the Chills. We opened for them, I think, six times in 2019. You know, 29 years later, same Martin Phillips. So we've had these wonderful experiences too, but it was really different back then. There was only word of mouth. There was only this kind of like loose coterie of people who made it their business to find non-commercial music that they hadn't heard a ton of on the radio. Most people weren't willing to do that. They weren't going to buy every fanzine and scour every press outlet that might cover these bands and listen to every college radio station that might devote 4 hours during the week on like two DJs to playing these kind of records. But that is the shadows that we all operated in together back then. And we took what we had. We took what we could get, basically.
I wonder sometimes about this, about, you know, the idea of... Well, I think in some ways, like, Seattle was probably, like, the last scene in American music. And there was, you know, there was that time where there was, like, a New York scene and a, you know, a Madison, Wisconsin scene or whatever. And I think that that's healthy in a way because, you know, bands start making records and they go on tours and stuff. But I wonder if there was also, like, a downfall to that where it was, like, you're a band from Boston and you can go Boston to New York, maybe D.C., but you can't go to Omaha.
Well, demand is a stickly thing. You know, our band wouldn't have broken up if there was demand for us on the level that we wanted. I always used to say we got four rungs up a 10-rung ladder. And so we were besieged by everyone in the rungs below us saying, hey, if you need a band, you know, to open for you on your next tour, you know, they'd hand us a demo tape and be like, I know you want to get out of town. You're sick of playing your local thing, but did you notice we drew 46 people to this show today? You really want to come on the road with us? You know, you want to get for a band that's like six rungs up the ladder so that when they play your town, there's 300 people there, not, you know, 44 or 46 or whatever, plus the sound man. We got to a place where a lot of bands wanted to be the absolute bell curve iceberg under the water. So they wanted to be us. So I really couldn't complain, oh, woe is me. We were on tour, we had albums. We were on MTV. We were interviewed in Rolling Stone. We were interviewed in the Melody Maker. Four rungs out of 10 rungs was not bad at all. The trouble is it was not sustainable economically. You can't go to, the gig I was just kind of mentioning in particular was in Oxford, Mississippi. Those people were just, the opening band was just the nicest. And of all the opening bands that I'm thinking about, I'm thinking of them most of all, because being from Oxford, Mississippi is the definition of being a music business dead end. You know, it was a nice little college town and nothing against them or their band or their city. But if you have any ambition to play outside of Oxford or make it up to Memphis, I guess, then you need something. You need to get past those first two rungs. And we were not the ticket out. And even having gotten to the fourth rung, without that demand is really what we're talking about in your question here. What do people demand? How do you get them to demand it? And how do you sustain that demand so you can continue as a recording and touring artist? The Chills got to like the fifth rung or the sixth rung. They got the major label deal. They could get 200 people to their gigs pretty much anywhere in the country. They wanted to be in the seventh or eighth rung where they were making actual money, not breaking even. And then, you know, by the time you're U2 or whatever at the 10th rung, the money is just rolling in and you can do whatever you want. But with that comes with a lot of baggage. I would have been happy just being in the sixth rung, just, you know, breaking even and continue on as a band or maybe making just a tiny bit of money or something, just so we could keep making records and tour. That's really what you want from your favorite artists, is this, a sustained career so they can give you more music. These days, you don't need to make so much money, because it doesn't cost so much money to record. And because of streaming, people know your music, they're more likely to buy a concert ticket. So though you don't get any money from record sales anymore, more people show up at your gigs and they know your stuff and they tell other people to check out your music for free. So if you can sell some merch and get some money from concert sales, then you can actually sustain a band on the fourth rung of the ladder these days, let alone the fifth and the sixth and seventh.
When you've done gigs now, do you see a young audience?
That's really interesting you asked that question, because as someone who interviews a lot of bands that come back, you know, or even like Bob Mould, who never broke up because he's a solo artist, a lot of them will say one of the things that inspires them the most is to walk out on stage and see people who are basically young enough to be their grandchildren. Because that means it isn't. Who has made this quote recently? I don't think it was even one of my interviews, but you know, I edit the other interviews in my magazine, The Big Takeover, and so I've been doing that the last 2 weeks. And one of the, I think it was Mike Giraud from the Swans. I'm about 80% sure said this in the upcoming issue of Big Takeover 96, that it's nice to look out, and it's not just a bunch of, you know, middle-aged guys with pot bellies when the Swans play. Okay. Or just Swans, And I totally got into that quote. I've been seeing variations of it now for well over a decade. I think Slow Dive are particularly pleased to see so many young people at their gigs who weren't born when they came out with Just for a Day and Suvalaki. I mean, you can't have any less consciousness than not being born. It certainly is the least amount of being your fault, too. Like, well, yeah, I'm sorry I wasn't into your band. I didn't exist. And my kids come to my concerts with me. I've taken Jim to like 25 gigs. Caroline's, I think, seen 8. You know, she's 13. So I never even saw a gig until I was 16. My parents wouldn't allow it back in the 1970s. Oh, yeah, sure. You're going to a rock and roll gig. Yeah, we're going to allow that. Even when I went at 16, they looked at me like scared, you know, like what den of iniquity is my youngest son heading out into, seeing the Talking Heads and XTC for his first gig in 1978. So, you know, it's a different world now. Kid, my daughter, she sits and streams Slow Dive, and she streams Always, and she streams the Beths, and she streams Sloan, she streams, you know, Wise Blood and My Bloody Valentine. Even like my favorite bands the last 30 years, I didn't even tell her about. She just finds them on her own. And now if I take her to see the show, she knows all their songs. So good for Slow Dive, basically. But good for any band to have their music more widely heard now than even when they were, you know, on major labels touring America. I saw Slow Dive with Ride in Detroit in 1992. There were more people at a Slow Dive gig now. There's 10 times more gig Slow Dive fans now than back then. And now every song they play, old or new, everyone knows.
See,
You just don't get record sale money anymore.
Well, I mean, I asked that because I went to see Colin Newman and Malka Spiegel. They have that project
Oh yeah,
Immersion.
Immersion,
Yeah.
sure.
And I saw them
Yeah.
in Memphis and in Nashville. And I mean, I'm 52 and I was, you know, they might have, well, just as well give me a walker, you know, because I, you know,
You
I
do
was,
immersion, really?
yeah, I was easily. Less so at the Nashville gig. There were a few geezers there, but certainly at the Memphis gig, I felt like an old man in some ways, and I was like, "This is amazing," you know, because you wouldn't think it, right? You'd think that it would be predominantly guys like me.
Well, imagine what Colin Newman must have felt because he turned 70 last year. You know, 70 when I was a kid sounded like, you know, you sit on the beach at Boca Raton. You don't tour the United States with, you know, your wife and play for people who are basically your great great grandchildren if you're from the South or something. I think Colin Newman is an absolute genius. Interviewing Wire for the first time in the mid 80s felt like I was in the presence of giants. So I don't blame you at all for going, and I don't blame young people at all for wanting to check out what Colin is up to. You know, it's not like he's ever done any music at all trying to sell records. He's just made the music that inspires him this entire going on 50 years, you know? I guess it's been 48 years now for Wire. Good God. That's quite a legacy. You know, but that's what I've always strived for as a critic and as a DJ and as a musician myself, is to make or support music that really matters just intrinsically. You know, I've always been amazed that people will not listen to music if it's something they've never heard of. It's a weird habit of the average music fan, not like the dedicated music fan, the average music fan. Like you try to play a song for somebody and like, well, I've never heard of them, as if that's a definitive put down. So if you've heard of them next year, will they suddenly get better? Will their music have improved? But the people who really believe in music and see its incredible worth to them, you know, they've been sustaining this all this time, and now we have reached a point where people can sample it for free, and they're being drawn to music that exists for its own sake. Its own artistic, you know, validity, as opposed to like, oh well, our entire modus operandi, our entire ambition is to make music that can get on the radio, and we'll tart it up with the most advanced radio-friendly production techniques, and we will, you know, engage in this incredible public relations campaign that's a total, you know, BS campaign, and completely stick up all this artifice. Instead of just saying, like, I want to be an artist. Music is just a form of art. I'm sure it's true in all the other arts too. The difference between a painting on the wall of a Holiday Inn and like Rembrandt is like oceans wide, or some more modern artist who's doing something just as interesting. So we interview people like Mike Girra, you know. I mean, what commercial record did Swans ever make that was, you know, radio friendly and designed to get into the radio charts and, you know, and do well in the production manager's meeting that week. But most of the bands that made that kind of music have come and gone. They were just too ephemeral. Nobody wants to hear their music now, a lot of times. I think here we are talking about, you know, a band that's been gone since 1993 that made a totally quixotic or quixotic. I don't know how to pronounce that word. Whether it's, I know it's Don Quixote based, but we made a quixotic third album for no reason, though. We just felt like making it. And here it is, 15, 16, 17, 17 years later. And more people are hearing it now. And, I'm talking about it more now because people are receiving it in that spirit and they can hear it for free. And they're going like, yeah, you made this really different third album, this weird orchestral pop, folk pop record that had so little to do with your first two albums. I just like hearing it. I love Bruce Leicher's packaging, whether it's me speaking or a fan speaking. Wow, this really was an attempt to make some, good music with some good packaging, some good art to give people something. That feels really good, so many years later. It completely validates our decision to make this ridiculous album. Or really any artist to make the albums they make if it isn't all about just trying to, to pander, even given that there's a wide range of tastes of what good music and bad music is.
On some level, I wonder sometimes, like, does it really matter that this album was made in 75 and was pressed on like a private press and then people forgot about it? Or does it matter that that it's good and it's finally finding its audience?
It only matters that it's good. I mean, my record collection is filled with records made by people who died before I was born. Hank Williams was trying to sell records. His record label was trying to sell records. He died at what, age 28, something like that? But he was gone 8 years before I even showed up, 9 years before I showed up. His records are amazing. Billie Holiday or Jimmie Rodgers, the singing brakeman, these people were dead decades before I came along. Their music is still very powerful. And there's a continuum. The one thing I liked about Nirvana was the way they would shine a spotlight on some very deserving musicians, whether the Meat Puppets, who are still benefiting from that 30 years later, or Lead Belly, who clearly wasn't. He was metaphysically challenged, our Lead Belly. If he had only known, he could have managed another 50 years of life. He could have opened for Kurt Cobain or joined Nirvana on stage for MTV Unplugged, Nirvana and Lead Belly together at last. Those records are powerful, and that's what inspires me. I was in the Beatles fan club when I was six in 1968. That's just a coincidence that the greatest band that ever lived was my favorite when I was in kindergarten, and as a preteen, and to this day, they're still my favorite band that ever lived. But once upon a time, popular music was really great music. And some of the people who didn't get popular, like the Zombies' second album, Odyssey and Oracle, or Arthur Lee and Love's album, Forever Changes, I consider those to be two of the 10 greatest albums ever made. The fact that they didn't sell records in 1968 and 1967, respectively, doesn't change the fact that they're absolutely astonishing musical art, and that they have been discovered by later generations is all to the good, not just from like a music snobbery thing, like, oh, well, I like this record that other people didn't at that time, but from inspiring people to seek out like-minded music or to make like-minded music. We tend to think of all the bands that have been inspired by great records. The Velvet Underground launched 10,000 bands, even though they were commercial flops in the 1960s. The MC5 and the Stooges were, and the New York Dolls were commercial flops, total losers when a band was judged by their record sales. And how many great bands have we been given? How many bands have been inspired by Wire, like starting with the Urinals and Minutemen and Mission of Burma, and then in the 40 years since? That's just on our side of the pond. And it's not just bands that are inspired, they're fans. Nobody talks about this. They always talk about all the bands that are inspired by a band, and that's really important. But even fans are inspired to seek out better music if they're being given better music. The one time I interviewed John Peel, I guess about 35 years ago before he died, he said something that has always stuck with me. He said, look, people give me way too much credit. All I do is play the records. What if nobody made those records? What would I play? And I know he didn't mean just records per se. He meant the specific really inspiring records he was playing. And some of it was commercially viable in its time, like The Move, which was, I think, the first record he played on the BBC in 1967, I think. Great choice, John Peel. Well done. But they were a hit band at the time, being ignored by the BBC because the BBC was not playing rock music until then. But a lot of what John Peel played, obviously, in his career was not so commercially viable, like Wire. He was a big Wire fan. They didn't have a hit in England. The Undertones were like his favorite band, I think. They didn't initially have hits despite his championing. You just champion music because it's incredible. And then the ripple effects are astonishing.
The zombies are a curious example, and I'm curious for your take on this. So I was writing for a free weekly here in Wichita back in 2004, and we would get, a lot of like Denton, Texas bands coming through. And it was like this whole generation of guys who were, they were younger than me, and they're talking about how much they loved Odyssey and Oracle. And I was like, that was always like a bargain bin record when I was a kid.
Amazing, isn't it? Used to get it for $2.
Yeah. And it was, I think it was their parents or whatever who turned them on to it, But for them, it was a seminal album in that generation.
Yeah, even before streaming, there were certain records that kind of stewed among the cognoscenti, to use a weird word. Those of us who really cared deeply about music, we would delight in turning other people onto those records. I used to make a tape with Odyssey and Oracle on side one, and Colin Blunstone's first solo album on side two of the tape, because of course you could fit two albums on a tape. This really incredible album called 1 Year, which is really kind of a zombies record anyway, because Rod Argent and Chris White are all over it as well. Closest thing to a post first two album zombies album, really, in those days. And people would just like to play it over and over and over. They just keep turning it over and over. And then I feel like I did my job. Not that I got paid for it, just people turned me on to music too. I didn't get this stuff out of a vacuum. I really liked She's Not There and Time of the Season and Tell Her No. So I made some little connections in my brain. And then I'd start asking around, was that it for that band? I always go looking for deep cuts. If you give me a couple of hit singles I like, oh, was that all they had? You know what I mean? Some bands, you go looking for more, like the Electric Prunes. The Electric Prunes have like 10 or 12 other tracks I enjoy, but the hits were really their towering achievements. Okay, fine. At least they gave us that and these other songs I enjoy. But then you find these bands like the Easy Beats or the Zombies or really the Beach Boys for a good 7 or 8 year stretch there, or the Pretty Things. There's all these bands that if you go past the couple of songs, there's this endless gold. It's like you've like thrown your pick into the mine and you open up this other seam and you're like, wow, look at all of this. And then you start telling other people that, hey, this band is really substantial. They're not just that song that you keep hearing on the oldies station. You need to hear the rest of their catalog. There's just like one great song after another. The Kinks, another great example. They had five or six hits. People love the band, But there's about 200 other Ray Davies songs that you need to hear in your life. You need to, if you care about music, if it's not just something you stick on in the background while you're doing your washing up, as the English say, as you're doing the dishes, as they say here. It's kind of an English phrase, so I'm using the washing up thing. And then there's thousands of bands like this. I've been covering them for 45 years, old and new. There's been brand new bands that you can't get a sniff. You're not that far from Lincoln, Nebraska. Well, Four Against made nine stunning albums from 1987 until about the end of the 2000s. You can't go wrong with a single song they recorded, like nine albums. And apart from really dedicated music fans, they only grew to have a little bit of a base in the 2000s in Europe and nowhere else. They could barely get arrested in America. Well, how did they get sustained for nine albums? Because there were these pockets of people who were at least passing on their music to like-minded music fans. And because they believed in their music and they could find labels who saw the wonders in it and put it out for them. This is how we've managed all these years. Nirvana has come and gone, and the music business has gone back to pretending that they care about music. They never did. not since really 1975 and 74. That was the last time they actually cared about artist development. So it's been up to us to basically be artist development. Us music fans and music bands and writers and DJs like myself, you know, I'm hardly alone in those designations. Here's what are you doing right now? Why are you interviewing Springhouse instead of a band that sells like 40 times more than we do and may get you a little more cachet? Possibly because we have some minor interesting story to tell in relation to this new album that might delight some people if they check out the music. That's all you need, really.
Yeah, I
We
mean,
don't sound like every other record you heard this week.
right.
But if you listen to our album, you'll hear plenty of Odyssey and Oracle. You'll hear plenty of Forever Changes and you know, Sgt. Pepper and the Dukes of Stratosphere and the Chills and you know, every great record Mitch and I and Larry have ever heard in our lives. The Stone Roses is in there somewhere. Every orchestral pop record we've ever loved, you know, even the first Blood, Sweat, and Tears album when Al Kooper was leading the band. Sid Barrett, you know, the first Pink Floyd album and the first two Sid Barrett albums, they're in there. I could go on for a half an hour. There's like 100 albums in our album because it's what you get from a lifelong passion of wanting interesting and moving music. A lot of bands are made up of music fans. And if they can synthesize all the stuff they loved when they're trying to make their own music and it comes out them instead of a pastiche of all the things they love, then you've got another one in the queue, in that line, basically, that you can tell people about. If it's your own record, all the more fun. I'll be honest, I played on this album one day. I did all 8 drum tracks in one day. And then Mitch and Larry, you know, toiled over it for 8 years, basically. All those overdubs and arrangements they worked on, all those production touches that Larry did, they worked their ass off for no other reason than just to make an album that the three of us would love. You know, kudos to them. R Ringo Starr learned how to play chess during the Sgt. Pepper's sessions, because if you total up the amount of time he spent on it was probably like 10 hours in all those months. You know, what else did he have to do other than singing A Little Help with My Friends, but just play chess and wait for them to say, okay, we'd like drums on this next track. And you'll do 5 or 6 takes of it and go back to playing chess. It doesn't mean that Ringo is not an important contributor to Sgt. Pepper. Of course he is. But that was the sort of record we made, you know. We made this very involved record. And so I didn't have a great role of it other than singing like Ringo, singing my one song on it. Time runs out. I guess I stopped playing chess long enough to sing that one song, you know, years after I did the drum track on it. But of such love or painstaking desire to make music that really means something to you and then share it with other people are all these wonderful records that we personally love made. Even Brian Wilson, I mean, he was a hit artist. He was top of the charts in 1966. He fucked with the formula, if you'll excuse the four-letter word. Because that's the phrase I always hear about it. He went and made the record he heard in his head, having been inspired by the Beatles, Rubber Soul. He wanted to make an intrinsically wonderful album and just hoped it would sell. And then the record company panicked and stepped over it by a greatest hits record, because that's what record companies do. Oh my God, it's not topping the charts. Quick, let's put out a greatest hits album for a band that's only been making records for, what, 4 years? Crapital records. Jesus.
I've never heard that one before.
Yeah. Again, you might have to bleep that out. Sorry. But that's what I've called them ever since I discovered that all those Beatles albums I bought as a little boy were not the real albums at all. That they'd completely screwed with all the Beatles records up until Sgt. Pepper. Even Revolver, which I regard as the finest album ever made in the history of mankind, they completely screwed my copy that I had for 30 years before I realized it wasn't the right album at all. And that they, in fact, had taken off three out of the 5 John Lennon songs on it. You bastards. How could you do that to me? What, he's not important in the band, John Lennon, really? You dump those songs onto Yesterday and Today instead? I always thought they were on Yesterday and Today. When you're, you know, 6 years old, you don't know that they're not really on this album, that this album is a total con job. And that's why there's this butcher sleeve that you've never seen anyway, because they recalled it before it got to your Corvette's outlet. We used to buy all our records in department stores those days. There were no record stores where I grew up in New Jersey in the late 60s. So my mother had to drive me 10 minutes, 15 minutes down the road to Corvettes. EJ Corvettes, I think they were called, by the new Beatle album.
From Now to Okay is back in the world and
ready to find
it. Be praised. Or Beelzebub be praised, depending on your religion, I guess.
I mean, that's got to feel good because it has the potential to find this new audience and earlier material potential to find a new audience, and so it goes, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been glad that Kafka's guy just to completely ignored his wishes. You know, Kafka and I guess like, oh, I don't know, J.D. Salinger, when he just stopped writing and refused to make any more books, and Greta Garbo when she just refused to make any more movies for another 40, 50 years or whatever. If you just think like, no, I'm done with this, or like Kafka, I don't even want any part of it, then that's something I understand. You made it for yourself and you don't want to share it, or you don't want to share it anymore in case of Salinger and Garbo. But that is like, you know, three examples out of what? How many? Most of us who are writers like Salinger, actresses like Garbo, or musicians, as we're talking about today, we make art and then we share it. So if you are taking that step and saying like, this is good enough to share, this is not just for me and my couple of friends or whatever, or me for my playback joy and I'm done here, then you're basically saying, I think this is a gift that I would like to share with other people. You know, put it under your tree, unwrap it, get some joy out of it, apart from what joy it brings to us. That's a highfalutin way of saying that, yes, if you are making music for the sheer love of music, you want other people to enjoy it. And the more, the better, since you didn't do it for any other reason than to get that high of the playback. To have created this thing and worked on it and worked on it and envisioned it and tinkered with it and, you know, worked on the lyrics until it meant something to you. There's all this stuff that goes into a song as we know it as a finished product. There's like 100 different factory departments all busily at work trying to get you this like wicket, you know, that's a really unique creation. And it feels really good. I won't lie at all. It took these 17 years. It was very disappointing, even though we expected it. You know, when you're disappointed, even when you expect to be disappointed, it's still disappointing. Like your team loses a game, you know you're going to lose. It's still disappointing. It would have been nice if you had pulled, you know, some kind of rabbit out of a hat and won the game. Well, this feels like we're getting a second chance at that. It feels like the intended audience is finally finding it. And I and we all owe Bruce Leischer and Jeffrey Clark, Independent Projects, about a debt that can never be repaid. Bruce is the one who got us signed to the Caroline deal in the first place back in 1990. Let's just say he has a lifetime free subscription to the Big Takeover for 35 years now for that one. And he's never stopped believing in our music. And that's what you need. You need somebody or something or some group of people who just keep saying, no, you need to pay attention to these people. They really gave us all a gift and you're missing out on this gift. Your life will go on having missed out on this gift. It's not like, you know, War and Peace, but if you were a music fan, here's another gift you can open that'll really mean something to you as opposed to just another like spoon-fed piece of drivel that the record business decided that they might, you know, sell some units on this week because it's lowest common denominator, not challenging to you. In fact, these days, even algorithms are dictating, you know, the hooks in a song and how to produce it so that it'll get maximum exposure. It's such a crock. Let's get back to that idea that music itself can be complete and totally inspiring just for the virtue of trying to create something unique and wonderful, and hopefully other people will find that in them. Absolutely wonderful that this record is back. Absolutely wonderful that people are listening to it. We couldn't be more overjoyed. I think especially Mitch and Larry, because they did work their butts off on this for so long, for no reason really, other than just the desire to see it through, to finish off and make a record so different from our first two ones that encompassed our wider range of taste instead of just hinting at it for two albums when we were a recording, touring, rehearsing act.
Well, as you go, and I just have one question. Seems like the big takeover, you've never thought about stopping.
This is
I think about stopping. I thought about it at 10 o'clock this morning. I'll probably think about it again around midnight when I'm like still writing my fifth review today. Like, why did I do this to myself? What kind of moron am I? I thought my parents raised intelligent children. Sorry, Mom. Sorry, Dad. Let down the side on that one. It's a tremendous amount of work, but it's not. I've had bad jobs in my life. You know, I got a degree in economics and got a job at an insurance company and wore the monkey suit for 4 years, even for an entire year while the band was getting going. And I'd get back from a gig in Connecticut at like 4 a.m. and have to be at my desk at 8:30. Oh, was that a slog? Not only for the lack of sleep, but the juxtaposition. Like, here I am going like, yes, I'll have that report on your desk at 10 o'clock, sir. You know, when last night I was, playing this incredible gig in New Haven or something. It's wearing no monkey suit at all. It's a place where I'm very privileged in that sense, that people will buy my magazine and sustain the magazine and advertise in the magazine and send the Patreon money that keeps my radio show going. You know, people are keeping me afloat, and I can't be anything but grateful about that. So when I am putting in these 80-hour work weeks every March and April and every September and October, and, bitterly complaining alone in my room to myself, I remember that I'm really quite lucky. And I'm doing something I feel some intrinsic worth to. If I turn on somebody to a band and then they write me an email a week later, I never would have heard of this band if it wasn't for you. Or I had heard of them and I just discounted them, and then I saw your raving review of them and I said, maybe I should give them another chance. Okay, again, that's not War and Peace. You know, I haven't done anything monumental in life, but I've had at least a small impact on someone, and they'll remember me kindly when I'm dead, which is not a really bad way to live your life personally, just to hope that people remember you well when you're gone. Dave Allen, Max Romeo, Clem Burke, just this week.
Yeah.
I remember all of them kindly. I never met Max Romeo. I met Dave Allen, got to know him fairly well when he was running a record label. I met Clem Burke 4 or 5 times and shared a stage with him when he was in Dramarama and spent half an hour having a drink with him. These are things, that you can do as a musician, is make something that makes people glad that you lived, that you gave them something that means something to them. It's a wonderful thing.
You've been listening to a conversation with Jack Rabbit of Springhouse. Springhouse's 2008 album From Now to OK has recently been reissued, and you can find out more information about it on the Springhouse Bandcamp page. Springhouse is also on social media such as Instagram, and you can learn more about Jack Rabbit's long-running publication, The Big Takeover, at thebigtakeover.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can send us questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find out more about all programming on this station at our website, kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We will see you next time.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.